Bluesman Lurie Bell with some sage words. Don't let the devil ride. Actually, it's an old gospel blues song, and it is part of his CD, his 2012 CD, titled The Devil Ain't Got No Music. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. And today, we're tackling a favorite subject here, and that is Donald Trump. Donald Trump. The man is a mystery, as Churchill said once, a mystery wrapped in an enigma, wrapped in a puzzle. And then, actually, when you think about it, he isn't all that deep. But it is the case that he occupies a very important slot. He's the president of the United States. And many people throughout the world, by virtue of his office, give him a great deal of deference. Lately, Trump has been touting his nationalist cards. Recently, as you know, he was in Europe, in Paris, commemorating, along with many European leaders, the 100th anniversary of the end of World War I, when the world looked to a new life emerging from the carnage of World War I, hoping together to live a new life, a life more promising, a life more plentiful, a life more democratic, with a small d. And there are arguments about whether, in fact, that was true, whether they had a right to expect such a thing, having played themselves a major role in creating strife. And then we had 100 years of it. And to a large extent, we are still seeing evidence of the turmoil that gripped Europe 100 years ago. I thought it would be a good idea to get a point of view from a journalist, a French journalist, French-born, Gilbert Messier, and he is going to help us understand the attitude from a European perspective. Not that he is a champion and spokesperson for Europe, but he will give us an idea of how the European community actually sees Trump. And are we headed toward a major collision with Europe, with the United States? Are we to expect a major collision growing out of it? Does Donald Trump not get it, that his policies and his conduct are just absolutely abominable? And do his advisors not see how important it is to rein him in? Gilbert, glad that you could join us today.
Be with you, Eutrice. It's always a pleasure. And my perspective is the one of somebody that was raised in France, but has been based in the U.S. for a very long time. So it's sort of a more, in a way, and also with my background, kind of a more global perspective. But, you know, that said, I think that I know everybody has this sort of love-hate relationship with Donald Trump. The way I see him, I consider that he's more like, sort of like an eczema, sort of a skin rash that kind of never goes away, especially if you scratch it. You know, so it's sort of like talking about him too much. It's kind of like doing him a favor, because one of his tricks, he's not a man of substance. He's really he's a sort of a and he has revealed that once again that he's really the quintessence, and that's the way he's perceived abroad. Is the quintessence of the ugly American that doesn't really know much of anything, and the kind of guest who always make a point to insult his host even before the party, like he did with Macron. I mean, the rudeness of the guy is just, it's truly mind-boggling. But it's all about, and my colleague on News Junkie Post, you know, Daddy Sherry, we have that conversation all the time. It's always about with them, and because of his personality, his narcissistic personality, it being the center, he always wants to be the center of the news cycle, and it doesn't matter what he's talking about. And as a matter of fact, you know, this strategy is no use by Trump wants to be everywhere, like the Jair Bolsonaro recently elected in Brazil, who is kind of a Trump wants to be, and also a fascist, because those people, I recently wrote an analysis in News Junkie Post, those people who claim to be populist and nationalist, well, we need to call, you know, those things by their real name. And the name is fascist. Trump is a fascist. Bolsonaro is a fascist. Salvini in Italy is a fascist. They are fascists, those people. And that's what they are. You know, nationalism, what is nationalism? Besides fascism, I mean, in that piece, you know, I kind of go through this Make America Great slogan again, but this is just like the Deutschland über alles of Nazi Germany, which is Germany above all else. You know, that's what it is. And look what we, you know, as a European who had many family members, great-grandfathers killed in World War One, which, by the way, you know, the U.S. has a lot of nerve to act like this great, you know, heroic stance of World War One. Let's remind people that they got involved in the war in 1917. It seems actually like a U.S.-American trait to get involved in war with their allies, their European allies, very late in the game, just like World War II, where the U.S. got involved in 1941. I mean, it's just, it needs to be, you know, there needs to be a little bit of a refreshing here in the, well, let's face it, the general ignorance that American, and especially Trump nowadays, but it's really in general, have for history. I mean, recently, Trump confused the Baltic states, okay, with the Balkans. That is very amusing. And it's just, you know, as I said, it's, if it wasn't a tragedy, it would be absolutely laughable. Unfortunately, it's a tragedy.
I'm going to go get my notes here. When the president of France, Emmanuel Macron, says publicly, he says that patriotism is the exact opposite of nationalism. Nationalism is a betrayal of patriotism. Do you have any idea what he's talking about?
Well, he's talking about something he doesn't know, really. Because Macron is the very first French president in history that didn't serve in the military. So out there, Macron talk about patriotism. Okay, I served in the French military. I had to. And I think the biggest mistake that they ever did in France was to scrap mandatory military service. And I've actually, I wrote about it many times. People didn't care for it too much. That said, Macron, the big brouhaha between Trump and Macron generated by the fact, and Macron is right on that for once, and I've said that years ago, that the EU, that Europe, should develop a real military force, a real European army. And I've added that they should also get out of NATO. Okay? And Trump viewed that, he commented about that on Twitter, he viewed that as an insult. But in term of geopolitics, okay, people have to understand here that there's something that somebody like Trump, through like Steve Bannon, was basically supporting the far right in Europe, Italy, Austria, Germany, France, Hungary. Some of them are in power, like Orban in Hungary, Salvini is part of the coalition, etc. All of those want to dismantle the Europe, the EU. And that's a goal that is shared both by Trump and Vladimir Putin in Russia. They seem to have that goal at stake. So the European Union has to defend itself against that, because otherwise they're going to be completely trampled, mainly by the Americans. So, yeah, Macron has a point, but he doesn't really understand, you know, like he made a huge faux pas that nobody really talked much about here in the U.S. before the 11th of November celebration, of saying that Pétain should be considered to be a war hero, and he paid tribute to Pétain, and people went really mad because Pétain was the head of the collaboration government in Vichy during World War II. He was pro-German. Yeah, he was one of the marshals of World War I. That said, he was also condemned to death, and he actually, the death penalty was commuted. He was a very old man by de Gaulle after World War II. But Macron doesn't really know anything about patriotism or nationalism. He kind of wings it. And in that sense, he has similarity with Trump.
That's what I thought. I thought you would observe. And in that sense, what is a similarity? You already said that you have two people, two heads of state, who really have a very truncated, or if at all, in the case of Trump, knowledge of the history of Europe and U.S. relations. And the
absolutely. And it's also very truncated in the case of Trump, of the his own history, which is American history. What Trump and many Americans do not realize is that without French military support, under the leadership of Lafayette and French money, the U.S. would have never gained its independence from the U.K., from the British Empire, as France financed the so-called American Revolution. And further, as a New Yorker, Trump should know that the Statue of Liberty was a gift from France to celebrate this precisely, the fact that France finance was on the side of the people in the American Revolution. So, I mean, where is that put into consideration? In what narrative it's put under consideration? None. You know.
The president obviously got several cold shoulders when he went to Paris. People kind of isolated him, or he felt isolated. It was so clear that he even cut short his participation in several different ceremonies in different venues, and made a clean break for it to get out from being surrounded by people he knew had problems with him, did not like him, did not get along well with him. What do you think? Trump, did it bother him a lot? Do you think that this was the reception that he got, that he was shown several cold shoulders in Paris? Is it something that he feels compelled to fix or mend?
Well, you know, I think that Trump, and I'm not the only one that thinks that, as a sort of an arrested psychological development, and unless people, you know, revere him and put him on a pedestal and said, oh, Trump, you are the greatest, you blah, 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 you know, he's not happy. He has to be at the center of attention. He cannot stand the slightest contestation or conflict. His ego bruised very, very easily. He's, as a matter of fact, he has extremely low self-esteem. You know, I mean, there's been a psychological analysis of Trump by psychiatrists and psychologists. Apparently what they're saying is it's often the case. Trump's father was extremely cold and authoritarian, and the mother didn't really show, was not demonstrative either. So he has this sort of perpetual need for adulation and attention. He has to be the center of attention all the time. He didn't go specifically, you mentioned that he sort of boycott certain event in Paris. One of them was the Forum for Peace on that was held on Sunday, November 11th, and he didn't go because he probably thought that talking about peace would be insulting to U.S. activity. And in that sense, he's completely right, because you have all those people. I mean, this is this thing was an exercise in hypocrisy anyway. Trump is not the only hypocrite in all this. You know, you have this little Macron guy, and he celebrates peace, and he wants to have those forums for peace held in France every year. But on the other hand, the French military industry is very, very strong. It employs 200,000 people, and they are the third seller of weapons to Saudi Arabia, after the U.S., of course, way ahead of anyone else, the U.K., the third is France, and Saudi Arabia is currently committing war crime in Yemen. You know, it's a genocide. A million of people are dying and starving. Compliment with weapons made in France. France is also sell weapons to the great democratic country of Egypt, and also India. So they're all into that game. You know, we live, and I've said it countless times, we live in a global war economy. And that also include the Russian and the Chinese. There's no angels in this. All of those political structures are controlled to some extent and financed by a gigantic global industrial military complex. I mean, you can see the war theater in Syria, and Daddy Sherry wrote about this brilliantly in an article called Other People's Country. The war in Syria, in her mind, is sort of like, was and is a way to show weapons, to sell weapons, okay? And it is. And the Russians are part of it. The Chinese are part of it. The Chinese are selling tons of weapons to Pakistan. It's so nobody can sort of pretend to talk about world peace. You know, it's like the people that fought, that really fought in World War One, not the general, the common man, they thought naively that they fought that war to end all war. And Utrecht, shortly after the end of the war, a very important event took place, which could have been good, which was the installation in 1920 of the League of Nations. The League of Nations was the ancestor of the UN, okay? And look what happened to the UN. The UN now is used to sponsor some kind of like soft warfare. The UN troops that are collected from various countries are kind of like a soft version, the so-called peacekeepers, a soft version of NATO. Okay, so you have an institution that's supposed to be a peace institution, was called again the League of Nations, but they're not doing anything. They're not imposing peace. You have war, as a matter of fact, since the armistice of 1918. There's been war going on all along. Okay, so 25 million dead in World War One overall, you know, World War II, 80 million worldwide, including everybody, and so on. So what have we learned? We have learned absolutely nothing. As a matter of fact, what Trump and his friends are doing are basically, they are serving the interests of the global industrial military complex. That's what they're doing, which, of course, it works very closely with Wall Street. It's the same thing.
Just the same, with all of these foibles that he's committing, would you argue that Trump nonetheless has had a powerful impact on how European leaders are now approaching this question of cooperation and reassessing priorities that are not going to be including war?
Well, yes, in a way, but unfortunately for the EU, Macron is sort of putting himself in some sort of leadership because Angela Merkel, has some issue with a majority political issue, and she's also tired. There's definitely a tiredness of power with her. And the rise of the far right in Germany. But I think what in terms of geopolitics, what the EU was always meant to be, and it was an idea that you know De Gaulle and Adenauer come up with in the mid fifties, was to be a third geopolitical bloc. To counterbalance the U.S. on one side and the Soviet Union on the other side. And that was never realized because, well, the real power wasn't there, and the U.S. never wanted that to happen, you know. So that's why, you know, the NATO thing kept going full swing. France, in the case of France, France was part of NATO up until De Gaulle decided to kick out the U.S. military, which was probably one of the best things he ever did. But again, you know, Sarkozy went back and rejoined NATO. So maybe that concept of, you know, a European army will take birth and will come to something, but I think you're Trace. I am completely opposed to warfare in general, overall. But I do think, however, that to have a military of conscript, to have a mandatory military service, is probably the best thing in a country can do for its own people, because it gives a sense to ordinary people how dangerous the military can be and is. My experience in the French military was brief. It was 1 year. But nonetheless, I was able to see what was going on. And people do not have that perspective anymore. They do not understand how dangerous the institution can be.
You know, do you think there's a rise in the far right in Europe, generally across Europe? You're seeing evidence of a galvanizing of effort, a sharing of political ideas that basically will create major divisions in societies. We have the ambassador of the far right, the ideological ambassador from the United States, Steve Bannon, touring all these European countries and not being well received, but the fact is that he is at work doing this kind of work. Do you think Trump administration, do you think Trump is attempting here to galvanize the white world?
Of course. It's Bannon is still working for Trump, and I mean, he's presented as an intellectual. Give me a break. I mean, he's not an intellectual at all, but he has a shop now in Brussels, of all places. He has a little shop in Brussels, financed by the Mercer, by Rebecca Mercer and Bob Mercer from the Mercer hedge fund, who more or less financed Breitbart and elected Trump, and are behind, on the board of organization, lovely organization, Christian fascist organization, like the Heritage Foundation, okay, in the U.S., a very, very powerful think tank behind Trump, 100%. And of course, it's that agenda. It's the agenda of racism, and of destruction of Europe. That's what interests Steve Bannon mainly. And I suspect not only Steve Bannon, but a bunch of people in the U.S. What they want, they don't want Europe with a political will, an army, able to resist anything. They just want docile people and an open market. That's what they want, okay? That's what they want. What Europe should do, whatever remains, I mean, my standpoint has always been radical and kind of always been the same. You still have 50,000 U.S. troops in Germany for no reason whatsoever. They should be kicked out by the Germans. It's the same with Italy. There's still U.S. troops there. It's the same with Spain. It's the same with the U.K. There's U.S. troops everywhere. You know, they should be kicked out. Now, maybe then the United States of America would learn a lesson in European nationalism. They don't want nationalism in Europe, really. What they want, the U.S. want an open market. And Russia, Vladimir Putin, for its sake, it's a good way to divide Europe and eventually completely splinter Europe, which is why they support the European far right. And that's the way it is. And it's also, in the case of the Russian, it's very ironic, considering that they're the one that took the big blow from Nazi Germany in 1941. They're the one who got 27 million of the Soviet citizens killed. Not the U.S., not even France.
What do you think in the short term about Trump amending this mantra of nationalism, because it's not really ringing you know, that well across the country. No question that it is ringing well with his political base, but not generally Americans. What do you think he will do with this concept of nationalism? He's pushing it pretty hard. Do you think it would take root?
Well, I don't know, Utris. It seems like, people are sort of confused because you see them also, the same people that claim to be nationalists, sometime in some part of the country that I know, that I'm sure you know, they have above their house or on their belt buckle or whatever the good old Confederate flag. So I don't know. I don't know what they see as nationalists. They see it as something that is more or less, in my opinion, white only. That is what they see as nationalists. White only.
Well, as usual, quite provocative, and I thank you so much for being available to have this discussion with us today. Thanks a lot, Gilbert, for being with us today.
Anytime, Utris, it's always a pleasure. And, you know, I think that, your listener, I do have some contact with them from time to time. I think they are a little bit more advanced than your average Joe in this country. But people need to be, I think people need to be waking up. You know, people need, I would say, from time to time, a swift kick in the ass. You know, that's what
merci,
I think. But
merci beaucoup. Merci beaucoup. We'll talk again soon. We'll take this break and come back. We'll take this break and sound you out when we come back about Trump's nationalism right after this. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Utrice Lead. The number to call is 888-874-4888. What does Trump mean by nationalism? Do you know? And do you approve, if you know? Or do you have some unexpressed views about nationalism? What is it? What does it mean to you? What does it connote? Chris from West Palm Beach, you're on the air.
Hi, Utrice. Good afternoon, everyone.
Hello. Thank you, and good afternoon to you, Chris. What is this nationalism business?
To me, as far as Trump's quote-unquote nationalism, I think that's just something he created from watching Fox News. He has no ideology. It's clear. It's just something he knows that the older generation of white folk who are open to that type of messaging, he knows that's the best way to reach them. I would back that up by looking at the people he chose to receive the Medal of Honor. All of those people are heroes to a past generation, to a specific set of Americans. So when he said, "I'm a nationalist," I can say it. Again, it's only to make sure that the same 30-35% of his supporters just stay on Team Trump. It's empty. It means nothing.
Do you expect that it would nonetheless take hold? I mean, the theory is that if you say something often enough, people pretty much acclimate themselves to it without much resistance. Do you think this is what is going to happen with his cry of nationalism?
There'll be some people who will pick it up, you know, who may try to run with it. But to me, I see those people as a dying breed. We are as much problems as we have in this country and throughout the world, in America specifically, those people, they don't have much time left. They really don't, as far as I see it. We're in a major shift right now, and to me, it's just the last throes of a dying population.
Huh. Thank you, Chris, for calling in and getting us started. Thanks for contributing. 888-874-4888. Donald Trump is hell-bent on marketing, you know, because this is a marketing idea more than anything else. The idea of nationalism, even though from what we have just discussed and what we know, he doesn't quite understand it. He didn't clearly understand how he would be alienating the European community by using that term. They've been fighting against nationalism. And his visit on the occasion of the observance of the 100th anniversary of the end of World War I, and they have not forgotten about Donald Trump's recent adoption of this nationalistic fervor, because they know what that means. In Europe, it's not a good word. Would it be the same here in the United States? What do you think? 888-874-4888. You know, you have to put things together. We just finished talking with my friend Gilbert Messier, who was born and raised in France, who now lives in the United States, who, as the editor-in-chief of News Junkie Post, has lived all over the world. You get a panoramic view of how people wish to live and the efforts they have made, sometimes unsuccessful, but almost always brutal if they're resisting, to beat back people who are pushing ideologies and theories that don't benefit people as a whole, but that create dissent, creates destruction, creates war. Khalil from South Carolina, what does Donald Trump mean by nationalism? Do you think he knows, or do you think he cares?
I agree that he is not that sophisticated, but I agree that he knows what that means. Definitely. I look back to the campaign trail when a reporter asked him, how does he feel about the support that he's getting from white nationalists, Nazis, and other subversive groups? David Duke in particular, he said, oh, I never heard of white supremacy or any of that. Who is David Duke? I never heard of him.
Yeah, and there's a lot of people he never heard of, but he's hired quite a few. he's never heard of them. Doesn't know them.
So yes, he absolutely knows what that means. And it really, it's like addition in a way. He's a white man in America, and he says he's a nationalist. So one and one equals two. But yes, he knows what he means. He's appealing to the Nazis and the white nationalists, which the fascist Nazi white nationalist faction in this country, because he knows that's his base. And I was actually shocked. I happened to be watching live when he said that on the news. He said, well, on stage. I was really shocked. I never thought. See, and I think we have to look at what he said in a greater context of this jigsaw puzzle that is this fascist coup that we're seeing. Because, you know, taken separately, these different activities, his words, his actions of he and his administration, when you put the whole puzzle together, this is the absolute fascist playbook. And yes, so this is white nationalism. That's why it's always hate the brown people. And we have to keep our country the way it is. And America first. I mean, that's just straight from, I'm trying not to get excited because I agree with your guest. It's just simple history. You know, the Nazis, Germany first. And let's remember, the very first thing, one of the very first things that Hitler said when he was gaining power as chancellor, I believe he was coming on as chancellor, Lügenpresse, you know, the lying press. Don't believe the media. The press lies to you. And let's look at what Trump has done. Now, he's inserted people in his personal life as well as into the White House who are from Fox News, okay? Bill Shine, that would be his Goebbels. That would be Trump's Goebbels. Now, he came straight from Fox News, and now he's inserted in the White House. We had Jeff Sessions, the Klan sympathizer. He was in the White House until he wasn't. Steve Bannon. I mean, he's out there, like your guest said, he's out all over the world pushing a far right-wing, quote-unquote, nationalism in a lot of Eastern European countries and places where it's always been, and it's trying to excite. And I think what we have seen, and this goes to our courts also, you see, this is the last stand. Now, I'm not saying that I agree or disagree. I'm just making an observation. Yes. This is the last stand of the Caucasian in the Western Hemisphere because of the demographic change. However, you know, the everyday working class white folks, it's not going to affect them that much because the power structure, the power elite is not going to change that much. And that's exactly why we have people in the Supreme Court like we do now from the Federalist Society to maintain that order. Because it's coming, but they're just trying to delay the inevitable. So,
well, thank you very much, Khalil. Very thoughtful contribution. Thank you. Bruce from New York. What does Trump mean when he says he's a nationalist? Hello.
I think he means a few things, but I think primarily he is claiming his heritage. You know, he is saying that my father is my father. And we know his father was arrested in New York City at a rally to support Adolf Hitler. I think is a claim to his heritage.
What heritage? His grandfather was a deserter.
Precisely. You know, the heritage of white supremacist thinking. You know, he comes from German stock. I think he's connecting himself to that heritage
German
of white supremacist thinking.
Like I said,
pardon?
His grandfather was just a regular schlub trying to make a living. Deserted.
Yeah,
in fact, he was being pursued for desertion in New York.
Yeah, but his father was a supporter of Adolf Hitler. You know,
yeah.
I think it's dangerous to assume that Trump is an idiot or he doesn't know, because people thought Hitler was an idiot too. You know, there was a long time they felt that Hitler was an idiot, right? But there's a certain logic to what Trump is doing, you know, and I think it's dangerous for us to underestimate him and think that he is talking about these things without having the intellectual or the historical or the ancestral knowledge as to what nationalism means to himself and white people who see themselves as being dispossessed by people of color.
Okay. So insofar as he thinks this, or you think he thinks this, and he is propagating that, what are we to do?
Well, you know, I have already made my judgment on this matter. I mean, it leads back to the same thing. I don't think there's much we can do. You see, the problem in the world is that white people generally have not given up white supremacist thinking as an organizing principle. Yeah? I mean, not even the whites on the left that are supposed to be our friends, you know? We still have a world that's dominated by the supremacy. White people can do almost anything in the world and you see nothing. You may see people starving or suffering from war. And once they're not white, you know, there's no urgency in the international community about it. Yemen comes to mind, for instance, you know. So white supremacist thinking is still the dominant organizing principle in the world. And I don't think black people can do anything more to stop white supremacist thinking. It will have to be white people who do it. And there's no movement on behalf of white people to do anything to stop white supremacist thinking.
But white supremacist thinking more and more is being shown as inadequate because people, white people, are moving away from that kind of thinking and they're making it known. They're understanding more and more. Yes, you make the argument based on race, but is also an attack against all other people on the basis of class.
But yes, that's true, but there are some more complications too. For instance, you will think that the nation of Israel or the state of Israel, right, would be against white supremacist thinking in Europe, you know, but they are finding, or even the Russians, as your guest said earlier, would be against white supremacist thinking. But the Russians, I mean, and I have a lot of time for Vladimir Putin, I mean, are supporting these same far right because they can achieve some type of political calculation, you know, dividing Europe, you know, getting rid of NATO and that type of thing, right? So, you know, there's some more complexities, you know. But generally speaking, I don't think that white people either in this country or in Russia, right, or anywhere else, have done enough to take white supremacist thinking from the body politic. And as a result, you still have a critical mass of white people who can be so galvanized as to produce a Donald Trump.
Well, that's a powerful observation. Thank you, Bruce. And we hear next from Mike from New Jersey.
Oh, hi, Utrice. It's always a pleasure
Hello.
To talk with you.
Thank you.
Hi.
Talking with you, too.
I think that Trump knows exactly what he's doing. I think he knows what nationalists mean, nationalism means, and he's implementing it on numerous policies, and it's so clear that he knows what it is. He's instituting trade wars, he's closing borders, he's erecting walls, every kind of division between racial, ethnic, linguistic groups. This is fascism. This is nationalism, and this is why, you know, I have a certain background, and the Jewish people know, you know, from 1,000 miles away, they can know what nationalism is. They can smell a Führer from millions of miles away. So this is what it is, and the other side offers globalism, neoliberalism, and so you swing between these two poles, and neither of them provides what the people need, you know. But nationalism, I think, is more dangerous. As soon as I heard Trump embrace nationalism, I ran and pulled every Democratic ticket there was. I voted Democrat straight down the line.
Do you think enough of white America gets it, that although it may play psychologically to the idea of superiority and safety in superiority, that it is indeed a very fascist ideology?
Yes, well, some people know it and some people don't, you know. Some people realize that nationalism leads to war, only war, and some people don't. Some people find security in it, and that security is false, and it leads to war. But the people who do find security in it are the people that fascism feeds on, or nationalism, let's say. But there's no question that Trump knows what it is, and he's instituting it across the board. Again, he's closing borders. He's instituting trade wars. He's putting up walls. He's creating divisions linguistically, socially, ethnically, in every way. Patriotism, religious divisions. So this is what it is.
Well, it's a powerful propaganda tool because what it does is that it also operates on the basis of fear of others. And this is proven time and again to be a very powerful influencer. What would it take for people to resist?
Well, they have to raise their consciousness. They have to be self-aware to resist that. Because without self-awareness, you know, they play into the fears, because this is a culture, a society that seeks pleasure, and the other, pleasure and fear are two sides of the same coin. We're taught in school to seek fulfillment, pleasure, success, and, you know, to get these things through possessions and identity. And so, you know, people are suckers for that because they're brought up on it. They're suckled on it.
It's a very dangerous time, you think?
Yes, I think it is. And I think, you know, immediately everything has to be brought to bear to bring it to the attention of the people what's going on, to make it clear that this is nationalism, it's fascism, it's leading to war. It's leading to isolationism. They're putting up the walls. They're closing the borders. They're instituting trade wars. And these things, we know, if you study history, they absolutely lead to war. They led to war in World War I, World War II, the Axis powers, the Japanese. It leads to war. And that's where we're heading.
Well, thank you for your sobering opinion, Mike. I really am glad that you called.
Thank you.
That brings us to the end of our program today. It was important, I think, to enlarge the discussion to include the European angle of it. So we got to appreciate how interrelated things are. And we also get to appreciate that in some parts of the world, Trump is not as successful as he thinks he is so far at gaining more and more, not just physical turf, but ideological turf as well. Thanks so much. Keep it right here at PRN, and we'll see each other tomorrow on the airwaves. Bye-bye.